I just read the interview you did with Brian McFandis.
Oh, not from ages ago.
And it was great. I just learned, you know, your whole arc up from the internship.
How to lie and cheat your way into Marvel Comics. So that's good.
Whatever works, yeah?
All righty. So we're going to... Is that everyone?
Hey, here you go.
Yes! That's everyone!
Close the door and nobody else.
This is not I have a question.
What's your question?
That's what you do if no one shows up. Okay. I guess we can get started. This is a really informal how to write comics. So now I can tell you the truth. There's few enough here.
No script.
Because I was okay. Okay, well, I guess we're about starting. It's not going to be more than this. Oh, this is great. So how many did Will Sportacio have? Two? Okay.
And actually, one of them wasn't him.
Oh,
like
that's...
He didn't even come.
Awesome. So let's see. We've already got like 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. We have 5 times as many people as Will Sportacio's. So that's how much butt we kick. 5 times more. All right. Most people, when they want to ask you, like, how do you write for comics, what they're really asking you is, what is that secret Masonic handshake I give Joe Quesada where he will immediately read my crap? And it doesn't exist. There is no secret handshake. There's no secret password. It's really hard. Do you guys want to know how to write comics or how to get into comics? Because those are two completely different things.
I'd like to know about structure, how you set up, what kind of
three-act
structure.
You want to know how to write the comic, not how to write... To get in,
maybe
the
a bit of both.
Yeah, but there's no answer to the second one.
Oh yeah, there's answers to the second one.
Okay.
you guys have read enough comics to know some guys don't know how to write comics, and they get in. Why not me? Why aren't I getting the check? And for that stuff, I'm not going to give you all those secrets because I don't want you going after my jobs. But okay, that one just went. But okay, so you want to like?
Well, there is an answer.
You can read lots of stuff about three-act structure or having, you know, interesting protagonist and antagonist, and you know all that stuff, right? You know all. The fact that you ask that question means you already know that stuff. We're talking about what's going to make a good comic. And for me, the best and most important thing, because what I want to talk about is writing comics for established characters, not coming up with your own guy and coming up with your own, you know, let's... A lot of what you're doing when you're writing for comics, especially for the big two, is what you're really doing is you're writing for licensed comics. You're writing for characters that already exist. And that means you need to know the property. You need to study the property and understand the property. If someone says to you tomorrow, hey, you know, we're running late and we need an inventory issue for really unpopular character guy. Like a couple years ago, Rob Tokar came up to me and went, he was an editor at Marvel, how would you like to do 2 issues of Night Thrasher? And yeah, okay. But anyone who's read my stuff knows I know all the minutia and all the little dinky characters. So, but then your job for that in that instance is to come up with the best Night Thrasher story you can. What I did for my 2 issues of Night Thrasher was completely wrong, and that's how you learn. I had a lunch with Rob, and I had this great story for Venom, and I just knew I could tell this. Oh, I'm just sitting there in my folder, and I just knew how to direct this great Venom story. And I went there with my friend Manny, because he liked leeching off us and getting free lunches. And this is usually he'd help out. Usually go, oh, that's a great story. Rob, don't you like that story? Everyone loved Manny. And this time I'm pitching Rob this great story. And then Venom's going to show up. We'll have a guest star from Venom, and it'll boost the sales. And Venom's doing this, and Venom's doing that, and Night Thrasher helps out, and Venom's doing this, and Venom's doing that. There's a little bit of Night Thrasher. And Rob was just sucking it all in, because it was a great Venom story. And eventually Larry Hama did something very similar to it in the Venom miniseries. While I was pitching the story, Rob was just totally sucking it in. He wasn't doing the job an editor should. And it was Manny, my pal, who was getting the free lunch, going, well, that's not a good Night Thrasher story, that's a Venom story. And that's when the light bulb went off over Rob's head. He was going to sign off on this thing. And he go, he's right. That isn't a good Night Thrasher story. And that's a very valuable lesson, which is your story, whatever you're doing for your licensed property, it has to be endemic to the character. So that's always a really good place to start, is look at what your assignment is and come up with the story or multiple stories that's the most endemic story you can to that character. Like, let's say we're talking about a Spider-Man story. What makes Spider-Man interesting to you guys as a character? What's interesting? There's not that many of us, so we can talk. What makes Spider-Man interesting to you guys?
He's a loser.
Loser. He's acrobatic. Yeah. He's kinetic. Anything else? Like what relationships does he have with other characters that are unique? What about his powers are unique? What about his motivations are unique? Because what we want to do is when we have a Spider-Man story, we don't want to tell a story that we can just rip Spider-Man out and cram Daredevil in and still get the same story. We want to write a story that's endemic to Spider-Man. So we can say to ourselves, he jumps around, he's a loser, he's a young character, he can relate to young people. Maybe we're going to do a story with gangbangers with superpowers that are his age. They got powers the way he had, but where he has power and responsibility, they have power and irresponsibility. That could be a good Spider-Man story. He's very acrobatic. He has certain kind of power skills. Walking up the walls, the spider sense. Maybe someone is going to blackmail Spider-Man into doing a crime that only he could do with his powers. Only his spider sense could get through that security system. Then when you start coming up with all these ideas, you could trigger off other things. Spider-Man's going to commit a crime. Oh, Spider-Man's friends with the Black Cat, and she's a criminal. Maybe he goes to her for help. Maybe someone already tried to do the crime with her, and she failed, and she's in prison. You know, there's one idea sparks another idea, sparks another idea. There's a book called Writing on the Right Side of the Brain, and it's got a very useful exercise where you would start, if I had a little sheet here, I would draw it. But you start with your character, and then you draw a circle around it. And then every time you come up with an idea that relates to that character or something interesting, you kind of draw it out like a satellite, almost like you're drawing a thing of the solar system. And then you take from that element, and then you draw out another idea. And then you start realizing as you get out to the third and fourth rings, what ideas link up to each other? What really unique idea over here links up with here? And suddenly, oh my God, you've got a story. That's a really good way to start. You want to make sure that it's your job as the writer of a licensed comic, which is what you're doing. If you're writing Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, or you're writing Earthworm Jim, or you're writing Spider-Man, you have to give the best unit of entertainment you can of that. So it's your job. You're working not just for the editor and not just for the company. You're working for the reader. And when the reader picks up an issue of Spider-Man, they want to read the best issue of Spider-Man they can. There are things about that character that attracts them to that book. So it's your job to find that thing and to deliver it. And also to give them something they haven't seen before. They shouldn't like read that issue of Spider-Man and go, oh, that was just like issue 246 5 years ago. I've been working on some projects with some guys where we're dealing with popular Marvel characters. And because I know all my comic book stuff, I'm the geek in the room. I'm always the guy going, they did that in, you know, issue 236. You can't do that. And everyone always looks at me like, maybe it's finding that story, if it's something very similar. You've got to remember, these guys have been around since, in some cases, the 1930s. And, oh, my God, how many times have we seen a story with this or that or the other thing? Like, look at Captain Marvel, Shazam. Mark Waid did a great story where he found a different way to use Captain Marvel's lightning. That they were fighting Shadow Thief. And by saying Shazam in a certain area, it lit up the room and there was no places where he could hide for a shadow. That was clever. And you're like, that's a really neat idea. I haven't seen that before. It's one of your jobs to find that out. But like the three-act structure, you also have to say to yourself, how does it help me tell a story? I had what I thought was a really clever bit. I got a chance to pitch a Moon Knight story. And I thought it would be really cool to have a scene where Moon Knight fights the Taskmaster. And this was ages and ages ago before he really did fight the Taskmaster. And I thought something cool that you could find was that at one point Daredevil was a boxer. That's when he lost the love of his father and went off to become a merchant marine. So I thought maybe it would be really cool if he's in a boxing ring. And he's fighting like some kind of boxing match and Taskmaster's seen him box. So he knows all his fighting moves. So you have the two of them going up against each other. And I had a clever bit, and I just should have shut up and left it with that bit, and I might have sold the story. which was, as he was fighting the Taskmaster, the way he was going to win was he was going to use the different fighting styles of his other three personalities. Like, he'd start fighting like a cabbie, like Jake Lockley. Or he'd start fighting like the way Mark Spector would fight, like a Marine. And that it would throw off Taskmaster, because he's like fighting a guy with multiple personalities and he's only studied one. And that could be a way where he could win. But instead, because I had all these Taskmaster ideas in a file somewhere, I said, if I ever got to write the Taskmaster, I'd use these ideas. That one of them, I thought, was whenever you'd see Taskmaster, you guys all know who Taskmaster is? Okay, Taskmaster is a supervillain, and his gag is, if he studies anybody's movements, he can reproduce them. So if he watched a Bruce Lee movie, he could do everything Bruce Lee could do. And one of the things that bugged me about Taskmaster whenever I'd see someone write him is they'd show a scene where Taskmaster would watch someone with superpowers do a feat. And I'm like, yeah, Spider-Man can jump 20 feet into the air. Taskmaster can't. He shouldn't be able to copy that. So I thought it might be really cool to do a story where he'd studied Iron Fist and studied all his martial arts moves, and then he tried to summon up the Iron Fist. But Iron Fist can do that because he has the spirit of a dragon inside him, and that goes to his fist, right? But Taskmaster wouldn't, and it would cause some major problems, and suddenly he'd fall to the ground like dead, but his fist would be glowing because his own spirit would be there. So I set up early in this Moon Knight story where he was studying Iron Fist moves, and he was getting so frustrated that he did that. And that was horrible storytelling, because what does Taskmaster using Iron Fist's abilities have to do with Moon Knight? You know what I mean? So even though it's a good bit, you know what? Save that when you're writing the scene when Iron Man fights, when Taskmaster fights Iron Fist. So I guess what I'm talking a lot now, because I'm just babbling, because I just found out I was doing this talk yesterday, was how to make your stories endemic to your character. So that's step number one. Whatever story you're writing for a licensed property has to be endemic to the character. I take a lot of crap from people about... we did a all Titania issue of She-Hulk, where we showed her entire history from... We gave her a very Dickensian past so that you would go, oh, she's a villain, but I feel for her now. So you see her entire life history, growing up in a trailer park all the way to when she gets her powers in the Secret Wars, and how She-Hulk is the first big superhero fight she has. And when you read the original Secret Wars, She-Hulk beats up on... Titania and She-Hulk beat up on each other, and it's pretty much a stalemate. Then all these people jump in and help Titania beat the living crap out of She-Hulk. And yet, when she comes back from the Secret Wars, they made Titania She-Hulk's villain, and they kept fighting all the time. And to me, that made no sense. That why? Why? Because you're the first person I met in a bar fight, so I'm going to follow you around for the rest of my life and keep fighting you? No. So what I did was, there's a window of time where the camera cuts away to She-Hulk and Titania fighting. And when you come back, everybody's joined in. There's a scene where Titania's fighting She-Hulk and all these other guys show up. And they all say, hey, everybody, let's go help her. And they all start descending. And then the camera cuts away for about a page and a half. And when you come back, everybody's beaten up on that character. So when I showed the whole life history of Titania, I showed you what happened when the camera cuts away. And what happens is, they're, hey, everybody, let's help Titania. Titania turns to him and goes, no, she's mine! And she goes and she starts beating up She-Hulk, and she gets her ass kicked. And that's when everyone goes, forget what Titania says, we're going to help her. So now she's suffered some major defeat. Now she has this thing in her gut that she has. So now she has a motivation. And I took so much hell from people sending me emails and private messages. That's not the way that fight went. And I'd write back, I'd send scans. Look, the camera went away. I'm playing fair. So you could say, did I play fair? I created this whole... It's weird, because do you guys come to the show a lot? Like, do you guys hang out and meet Ty Templeton? Anybody? Isn't he cool?
Yes, he is.
We worked on the Batman Adventures together. And one of the things that I hate the most about Batman, because Batman's one of my favorite characters, but there's this thing I just can't stand about Batman, which is he has this perfect, beautiful, pristine origin. He's with his parents get killed, he vows on their graves, he roams around the world and learns everything he needs to be to become Batman, and he comes back. That's pretty much Batman in a nutshell. And every time someone wants to do an important Batman story, they add to the origin. And the origin, there's no fat on this origin. It's beautiful. It's simplistic. It's mythic. And every time someone wants to pump up their character, they add one more wrinkle. Well, the night before his parents were murdered, his mother read him Alice in Wonderland. So now he deeply cares about all the Alice in Wonderland characters, especially the Mad Hatter. Why did you do that? You know? Yeah, and then you get the story where the week before his parents were murdered, they went to the movies again, like before. They went to another movie. And when they were at that movie, Bruce was getting bored. So he went up to the projection room where he met young Kurt Langstrom as a boy who was playing with a dead bat. And he goes, wow, you know, when I grow up, I want to study bats. Bats, they're yicky. You know, and you're like, so now he's met young Kurt Langstrom. He's read Alice in Wonderland. Oh, by the way, his mother was working for a charity organization, and she was aware that someone might be stealing the money. So maybe that mugger was a hired killer. Maybe he was working for the League of Assassins. Maybe, you know, one more thing. He ends up having like a million people cramming in the night of his secret origin. So I understand when people get really upset when you go in and you add that one little, no, She-Hulk beat her up. You know, give me a break. It's Titanic. It's not Batman. And so you were saying you should be familiar with your property. Yes, you need to be familiar with your property. Like, because I think a really good practice for me coming up through comics is I work through licensed properties. And you'd have to study that Bible. And you'd have to, if it was a video game character, you'd have to play the video game all the way through so you knew about them if you're going to write the comic. Things that seem obvious. You need to do your homework. I did the 75th issue of Looney Tunes where we did a story where the premise was really simple. It was fun. Where Bugs Bunny goes missing after he and Daffy Duck have some knockdown, drag-out argument. And everyone assumes he's dead. And everyone assumes Daffy did it. So it's a murder mystery. Daffy has to go through the entire Bugs Bunny rogues and as a detective. It was really cute. But it meant that I had to get everyone's voices right, and it had to be funny, and I had to understand. So I had 48 hours of Bugs Bunny running on a loop for days while I was writing this. So I made sure that every single guy, from Marvin the Martian to the guys that shove him into the trunk to every single Bugs Bunny villain there ever was, the Scottish golfers, the everyone shows up in the story for a page. On a side note, one of the fun things, it's always fun to sneak stuff into a comic. We had a horrible date rape joke in that comic, and DC Comics let us do it. It was really fun, where you see the first guy, Daffy Duck goes to. We're doing a tangent just because it's fun. Daffy Duck goes to Elmer. And you have a couple of funny scenes with Elmer. And at the end of the whole Elmer sequence, Elmer goes, but seriously, Daffy, I couldn't have killed Bugs. Because, look, it's not rabbit season. It's duck season. They do that whole bit back and forth. No, it's rabbit season. Duck. But before we even do it, we have Daffy go, no, it's not rabbit season. It's duck season. You know, so we did the whole thing. So going back and forth. Duck season, rabbit season, duck season, rabbit season. And finally, Elmer rips down the last one. He goes, it's mating season. And then he looks at Daffy. He goes, oh, joy. Oh, rapture. And then you cut to this shot of Daffy leaving Elmer's house. And he's covered from head to toe in cartoon kisses. And his clothes are ripped up. And Elmer's leaning out the window. And he's got lipstick on. And you have Porky, who's been Daffy's assistant. You know, because they're doing the whole trench coat thing. Going, so how did it go? And Daffy's like, we shall never speak of this moment again. And Elmer goes, call me. And I got in print. So that's another fun thing. Is sneaking stuff in print is always fun. I'm like, wow, you let me do that joke. And then a couple weeks later, I couldn't do this thing with a magnifying glass setting someone on fire. So go figure. But yeah, everything's got to be endemic. I was saying to someone, like, what's the first rule about writing? just a couple minutes ago because I didn't know what I was going to talk about, but I think that's apparently obvious. There's simple things about writing for comics, and they seem really obvious, but the first one is wear pants. There you go. That is my biggest rule to anyone who wants to freelance write: wear pants. When you wake up in the morning, put your pants on. You're going to be at home. There's going to be a million things that are vying for your attention. There's going to be a TV, or if you're like me, there's video game systems, and there's the phone, and there's the internet, and there's going to be a really nice feeling of, well, I can order food in, or I got a fridge over here. I'll just sit around in my PJs or my boxers all day. You're going to get so much more done if you just get up in the morning and put on pants. So there you go. Everyone can tell, writers write this, that, the other. Everyone can give you these three-act structure rules. I'm telling you the way it is. Yes, writers write, but more importantly, writers wear pants. Put on pants. That's rule number one. There you go. what other words of wisdom can I give you?
The no staple thing that you're talking about?
Oh, well, that's the no staple rule. That's a golden rule of mine if you're pitching. So here you go. If you're pitching a project, because before I came in, I think we had a little vote, like, did people want to know how to write comics or how to break into comics? That's a breaking into comics rule. The hardest thing to do when you're breaking into comics, if you're an artist, it's so much easier to break in if you're an artist than a writer. Because editors have no time. And editors have this magical device called a Rolodex. And in this Rolodex, they have the names of writers who have written before that they like and artists who've drawn before that they like. And they can just go to that. They're under no obligation to use you or to use your stories. Because they have this whole stable of talent they can call on and get these comics done, and they know what the end result will be. Tom DeFalco used to say when he was editor-in-chief that a lot of times people would pester him, I want to write a comic, and he would say the easiest way to get rid of those people was to hire them. That you give a guy their first assignment, and 9 times out of 10, because you think, oh, this wouldn't happen to me. If someone said, oh, I could write a story about Wolverine, I'd be there the next day with my full plot. And here you go, Mr. DeFalco, sir. But the truth of the matter is, you get that assignment, someone says, you get to write an issue of Wolverine. They lock. They are filled with terror and fear. Fear of the blank page or the blank screen, of not having the good ideas, of everything's been done before, they'll realize I'm faking it. Oh, my God, I don't know what I'm doing. Ah! And they just lock up, freeze, hide under a desk, and you never see them again. So that's the other, that's something we'll get to later, but like, if you get that assignment, dear God in heaven, write it. Get something in. If you tell someone you're going to get something in by a certain time and date, do it. Even if it's not up to the standard you would like it to be, do it and get it in. Because so many guys just don't get it in. And this is, even though I'm sure a lot of you have been waiting for Ultimates 13 for a long time.
Because they're not wearing pants.
Oh, Jesus. I used to be an assistant editor, and I was on staff. And there was a very important book. And when it was coming out, it was a top 10 book. And they had an artist working on it. And he was one of these super megastar artists. And this is back in the 90s. And this guy was huge. And he was going to grace the world with his presence and do 3 issues of this one title. Which is going to descend from the heavens and do this thing. And it was hell getting the work out of this guy. And the schedule, and oh my God, it's coming out. We got to get a book out. We're 3 weeks from shipping, and where the hell are the pages? And my editor, and it's really funny because the editor was one of the most tightly wound men in comics, calls this guy up, and it's such a huge talent that he's like, hi, how's it going? So the pages, we're going to get pages? That kind of stuff. And the guy's on the other end of the phone, and he's doing this, hey, check this out, DC just gave me this phone, it looks like the Batmobile. I'm talking to you on the Batmobile. Those pages. He's like, look, it has a voice-changing option. No, I'm Batman. Look at me, I'm Batman, talking on the Batmobile. And yes, but we're going to get those pages in this week? Yeah, okay. You're working, okay, that's good. Okay, goodbye. Hangs up the phone. He's talking on the fucking phone. He just started blowing up. It was really fun. So, you can't be that guy, because you haven't done the work yet. You know, when you've done that job and you get on Wizards top 10, then you can be a flake. Until then, you must get the work in on time. If you get the work in on time, you will get more work. Even if it's not the best thing in the world, you can't be afraid that your job, the job you're working on, is horrible. I do this all the time, and Tom Brevoort wants to beat me up. You have a safety net, and that safety net is your editor. That you're going to take your best shot, but at the end of the day, and this is going to sound crazy because anyone who just picked up She-Hulk 17, you know it was 2 weeks late, and that's my fault. But you need to get it in. You need to get it in and get it in on time, and if it's needs a fix, your editor will ask you for a fix. So, yes, if you get the assignment, do it. When you're pitching your idea, it's really easy when you're an artist because editors, they have no time. They got the magic Rolodex. You can show an editor artwork, and the editor can look at artwork and go, this is good or this is bad or you need to do on this. And this really takes no energy or effort from the editor because they're just looking at pages. But you hand an editor a script or a plot, they got to read it, they got to flip through it, and they've got plots and scripts on their desks from you know, top 10 Wizard guys. There's a Jeff Loeb script on their desk. What do you think they're going to spend their time doing? Reading your submission or reading the Jeff Loeb script they got to get out next week? So what you have to do if you're trying to pitch an idea is you have to boil your idea down to one page. As my rule of thumb for new writers, the fastest thing that will kill your pitch is a staple. If they think they're even going to have to take the energy to flip to page two, they're not going to look at it. I'm being blatantly honest with you. So you have to get your idea down. So you have to come up with the best damn idea you can for that character. Make it endemic to that character and get it down onto one page. If your idea is promising and it's good, even if they can't use it for some reason, even if they have a story that's very similar, they're going to run in 2 months and they could never buy this story from you. If that story shows promise, your contact information is on it, they'll call you and they'll ask you for another pitch. You're not trying to sell that story. You're trying to sell you. And you're trying to get your next story. You might not sell that. They might ask you for a million changes. You know, go for it.
You're saying a writer should spend like a one-page synopsis, but how about just making the comic with a friend? It might not look beautiful,
no,
but there you go.
No, 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 no. Everyone does that. Everyone thinks that. I'll get my friend. You know, you think it's like that Judy Garland thing. We got a stage. We'll put on a show. No, having your friend draw your comic idea is the worst thing you can do. Because your friend, unless your friend is Alan Davis.
It is.
Yeah, then you're good. Because
okay.
There are people who get work that way. Alan Davis is my friend. He drew this for me. That looks great. Unless your friend is Alan Davis, it's not going to work. Because your friend, his art is going to be substandard. And they're thinking, it's serving two masters. Your friend's trying to break in as an artist. You're trying to break in as a writer. That'll be great. But chances are, at least one of you is crap. And I love you very much, but that's the truth. One of you. Either you or him are crap. And in that case, you've got your friend who's a great artist drawing a crappy story, or your great story being drawn by a crappy artist, and it's serving no one.
He's looking for writing. He was focused on the writing.
No, he won't. Because he's not looking for writing. He's looking for everybody. He's looking for a letter. He's looking for an artist. He's looking for... Don't... No. You have to be true to one master. Turn in your story. Turn in your art. Do not. I swear to God. It'll go in the trash can so fast. You think it's a great idea. It feels like it should be a good idea. I'm telling you, 15 years of experience, there are trash cans filled with that. Do not have your friend draw your stuff. If you're writing a story, do not have a friend draw up a clever cover piece. Oh my God, there is someone at Marvel, and this is going to chill you to the bone, because I've seen them. People think that, wow, I've got some good art, or I've got some clip art, or I've got something, and if I go to Kinko's and use the world's best document layout, and I do a clever thing so it looks like you're actually reading an Avengers briefing, or this came from Professor X's stationery, if I do some... No, you're not trying out to be a graphic designer. You're trying out to be a writer. And there are so many of these. There's so many of these to choke the marble, that there's a submissions editor, and their job is, the first stage of their job, is if your submission does not comply to the submission guidelines, it goes in a pile just to be tossed. That beautiful thing that you spent all that money on at Kinko's, that you got the perfect see-through binder, that you did all this stuff, and you thought, I'll be the only guy gussying it up. there's a mountain of those, and they all go into the trash. And not only do they go into the trash, and this is the secret, someone sends you a submission letter saying, thank you for your nice effort. We really appreciate the time and energy you put into this. It's a form. And it goes to these guys, and all that hard work and love and all that money that went to Kinko's goes right in the trash. Do not do this. Be true to your story. Make it the best story you can and get it down to one page. I know you don't want to hear it. The only thing that could help you out with that one page, the best thing that could help you out with that one page, it's going to be really hard for you to break into Marvel or DC. That's like saying, I want to start off in the industry and I want to start off at the top. You know, I want to work at the number one or number two company. You stand such a better chance of breaking into the small indie. If you, that one page where you put out your best idea, if you put with that page a finished comic book with staples that came out and people bought, that is a great thing to include with your one page. Because that says to your editor, I have the energy, I have the desire, I have the drive, and I got it done. I can get things done. Look, here's a finished comic. Even if that comic is drawn by your friend, and that comic came out through an indie, that's fun. Like, there's a comic called Sticks Cab, or Sticks Taxi. It's very crudely done, but the stories are kind of nice. A guy puts that in with his one page, he stands a shot. Tom Bedlund, who does True Stories, Swear to God, has started getting some Marvel work, because he can take an issue of True Stories, Swear to God, and a plot for a Spider-Man thing, and an editor will look at it.
What about this thing where they say we cannot accept any unsolicited materials whatsoever because of people, blah blah blah, so you can't, if you send it in unsolicited, then they're just not going
to
read anything.
Well, no, but you can, actually, no, you can send it to the submissions editor, it's hard, and you can send it to, you can send it to care of editors, but you always run the risk of they have a very busy day or a very busy week and they're not going to read it. But yeah, they're not, they don't owe you anything. It's harsh, because you spend so much of your life growing up and reading all these comics and knowing all the characters, and you feel like you put in this financial investment that I bought all these comics. And you feel like, I deserve a shot. I should be able to get this onto an editor's desk. It's hard, because the editor really doesn't, not that he doesn't care about you. He does. He cares about you as a reader, as a consumer. But to actually cross over and to start working, he doesn't owe you. They don't owe you, and that's such a hard, crushing, terrible, soul-wrenching blow. And I'll tell you, I have my first rejection letter from Marvel. I have it framed. I love it. It's great. It sits up on my wall. Years are at this point in time, blow. I thought they were great stories. I had Mysterio took over a S.H.I.E.L.D. satellite, and S.H.I.E.L.D. had to get Spider-Man to help them take it down. And all these, like, Wonder Man shows up at a movie premiere, and someone attacks him, and Wonder Man's able to defeat him because of blah, 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 blah. I had these three stories I sent in. I labored over them. I was so happy you get your little rejection letter. I later met the person who actually sent it to me. But, you know, it's cool. It's up on the wall. It's a way, and you're going to get a lot of those. And you have to keep trying, and you have to keep trying, and you have to keep trying, and you have to keep trying. You know, if you, oh, here's another good one, and I know it's an obvious one, but allow my failures, allow them to let you to overstep them. Don't submit something you don't want to write. I know that sounds really obvious. A lot of times, you're going to want to impress an editor. Like, I'm a fountain of ideas. I have a million ideas, and you're going to pitch them, like, the three stories you want to do, and just to show them how good you are, you throw in another two stories you came up with that morning. I swear to God, every time, it's, if you have 12 stories you pitch them and you threw in that one extra just to make it look like more, it's insane. It's like they have a radar. They will always go to that idea. And suddenly you're like, I don't want to write the story where Tigra, where someone's going after her because they think she's wearing fur. That's stupid. Why did I put that on the list? That happened to me with the West Coast Avengers Annual. I pitched all these great ideas, and I'm like, I don't have a Tigra idea on there. What if someone thinks she's wearing fur? That's good. Ding. And the editor goes, hey, that's really good. They think she's wearing fur. Write that. I'm like, but what about the Wonder Man one with the thing? And that happens to you all the time. You never add that extra thing. To just put stuff in that you're comfortable with that you want to write. Because someone will turn around and ask you for it. What's cool is sometimes you get the opposite, where there's a really great book, and they're starting it up again for people who want to try to break in, called Marvel Comics Presents. And if you're a reader, on behalf of all Marvel, I deeply apologize for any issue you read of Marvel Comics Presents, because they're horrible. But what they are, all these 8-page stories. And it's for guys, it's a dumping ground for guys trying to break into the industry, and Marvel giving them an 8-page shot. And I so wanted into that gold mine. I so wanted to be able to go in and do all these Marvel Comics Presents stories and show people what I could do. And I'd already sold a story or two to Marvel, but I was having a hard time cracking in there. And this other writer, you guys know who Scott Labelle is? Yeah. Scott was really nice to me when I was trying to break in. And Scott went into that office, and they were doing the Namor book. And they had a Namor annual. And they thought they were short 8 pages of one Namor annual. And then, well, what characters do we have? We have Spitfire. We don't have a Spitfire story in here. And Scott was in the office going, hey, you know, my friend Dan Slott, he's got a Spitfire story. He was talking to me about it yesterday. He's like, really? Well, get him to write it up and turn it in tomorrow. And I'm sitting there in my office working at Marvel on a staff position, and the door opens up, and Scott Labelle pokes his head in. He goes, hey, Dan, you got to write an 8-page Spitfire story. Make it good. It's got to be in tomorrow. I'm like, okay. And I did. It was a really lousy story. But they liked it. And they were the Marvel Comics Presents office. And they end up not running it in Marvel Comics Presents instead of Namor. But for that same thing, when I turned in that pitch for here's the Spitfire story I want to do, I included a bunch of Marvel Comics Presents pitches. And they bought some of those, and that really helped my career. Like, you guys know who Joe Maj is? Joe Matawera? That same issue where that really crappy Spitfire story came out? His first published work from Marvel came out, and it's a story with me, with Mojo. It got reprinted a zillion times, and it broke me into the X office. So, yeah. You never know where it's going to come from, and you always got to grab it when it gets there. And you always got to turn it in when they tell you to. Any questions about anything, about writing or breaking in? Yeah.
I just have a question. If you don't want to answer it,
I will totally answer it, unless it's about downloading comics.
Starting out, what do you expect writing, like, your very first story? What's something you expect from the Marvel DC, like, for, say, your first issue? Like, hey.
Oh, how much are they going to pay you?
Yeah, or for opening art, starting artist, or starting writer.
Next to nothing.
Yeah.
they're not going to pay you that much.
Oh, like, ballpark?
Well, here's the scary thing. It's really hard for me to gauge that, because when I started out, it was $30 a page for plot script, and if you're on staff, they bumped you to $35. So I was getting $35 a page, and then every so often you get a review, and they bump you up 5 or 10 or whatever, depending on your profile. And then if something happens like, well, I'm not under contract, and I'm working for DC. And then DC goes, Marvel pays you this much a page? We'll pay you this plus 5. And then I was working for Acclaim, and they're like, DC pays you this much? We'll do that plus 10. So your rate starts going up. And then you come back to Marvel, and you go, well, these guys are paying me 10 more. We'll pay you 5 less than that. You're like, thank you. No, Marvel's great like that. When you're on staff, you know, you're on staff at DC, they're like, it's Arbor Day. DC is closed. We're celebrating Arbor Day. And you're like, Marvel? They have them there on Christmas morning sewing wallets with their feet. You know, it's a completely different atmosphere. You know, it's like, aren't you guys in at DC? It's Martin Luther King's birthday. Like, okay, you're gone. And over at Marvel, it's completely different. You're like, can we leave? I'd like to celebrate New Year's, please. You know, it's completely different.
Just to tag on to that, what about royalties for Draft?
You're not getting royalties.
Nothing.
Well, here's the thing. You're going to get royalties. Most companies are much better than Marvel about getting them, but you're going to get royalties when you hit certain levels. So chances are, if you're not working on a top 10 book, you're probably not going to get royalties for your stuff until it's reprinted into a trade paperback. And then you'll get royalties. There you go. But I think one of the questions are, like, how many books do you need to be writing to make a career? to be living comfortably and not eating cat food, you're probably looking at more than a book a month, 2 books a month, which is just about how much I can handle till I start falling, you know, crashing and burning. So, yeah. But it's good. Hi.
Do you feel that comics are sometimes just screenplays that you just don't have the money to make the movies that you make the comic version?
No. Comics are the greatest, coolest thing in the world because it's a screenplay without a budget. I can say, and 12 cars blow up. Ding! And it costs nobody nothing. Someone draws 12 cars blowing up.
But in format and style, creatively, it's basically a screenplay, basically, right?
Well, there's a lot of different ways. There's a really good book called... what's it called? There's two books of them out where you can... All they are different writers' comic scripts. I want to say Act 1 and Act 2, or Scene 1 or Scene 2, or Right Now, or it's something...
Right Now Magazine does that.
But there's two actual books where you can just see everybody's different scripts, and you see how different a Neil Gaiman script is to a Dwayne McDuffie script, to a Peter David script. Everyone kind of has their own form. I'm a dinosaur. I still do something that's pretty close to what's called Marvel style, where what I do is I write a panel-by-panel description of what I want. I include an indication of the dialogue, or if anyone read She-Hulk 4, that was pretty tight because I wanted some of the specific jokes, like the why does J. Jonah Jameson really hate me? Is anyone? That bit was like word for word. But for the most part, I leave it loose to allow my artists a lot of freedom and creativity for how they stage the scene, or sometimes even how they break it down into panels. But usually I do a panel-by-panel breakdown, and when I get the art back, then it's like adding Foley or sound to a silent movie. Then I get to decide what everyone's saying. But I've already given myself indications in the plot, you know, what's going on. But it also allows me the fluidity that if my editor has a problem with something, I can fudge it in the script. Or if someone does something, I can, you know, if the artist gives me a gift, like the way the character is emoting or acting, it might spark an idea. And I can fudge that in the script. But like I've seen a lot of Mark Guggenheim scripts recently because we've been doing stuff back and forth. And his are pretty tight. And he's a writer for CSI Miami and Law and Order. So he's used to writing like a screenplay. It's different for everybody. And it also depends on how well you know your artist. When I was doing Ren and Stimpy with this artist, Mike Cazala, we were like that couple that no one wanted to play Pictionary with. Where you just kind of draw a little squiggle and they go, unbearable lightness of being. Yeah. And everyone's like, oh, we're not playing with them. So, like, my scripts to Mike could read, like, you know that thing we talked about on the phone last week? Let's do that thing, but let's do it with Twinkies instead of a mop. And you'd be like, and then you get the art back. But if I did a script like that to Juan Bobillo, I don't know what the hell I'd get back. It could be the weirdest thing in the world. So it also depends who you're working with. Or like, for example, my pal Paul Pelletier, who I did Great Lake Adventures with. Paul has a weird way of working. Paul reads the whole script, and then it's kind of fuzzy on it. He has a basic idea. So he'll read the page, and then he'll draw a page. And then he'll read a page, and he'll draw a page. So I know that working with Paul. So I know I'll write notes in, Paul, this cannot be a man. We're going to unmask them at issue on page 22. It'll be a woman. Do not draw this character as a man. You know, because I know that going in, that he's going to read a page and draw a page. So your plots and scripts change drastically with who your artist is and how familiar you are with them. Working on Avengers the Initiative with Stefano, he lives all the way in Italy. We do a lot of emails back and forth. And if he's stuck on something, he'll email me with a question. And then I'll draw something and I'll scan it in and I'll send it. So it's different with everybody. I had a really scary project. You'll see what it is and you'll hear about it in a couple months, but it's all top secret now. And it's huge! It's enormous. But we didn't know who the artist was who was going to get this script, but we knew it was going to be someone huge. It was going to be someone really big in the industry because this is an important thing. So that was scary for me to work in that void. So I was writing the tightest script I could, almost like a TV script, because I wanted to make sure that guy got a very tight script. Conversely, I've seen some guys that are big artists that when they get a tight script, they go, I'm not sure on that.
Yeah,
And they just draw what they feel like a little. And as long as they feel they get the basic beats, then you're good. And those people drive me crazy. But it's different with everybody. I knew I had something really cool that I could tell you, some pearl of wisdom, but now it's gone. But yeah, it's totally different every time. Any questions or about writing for comics or breaking into comics or? Was that episode of Lost great last week?
Kind of question. Actually, Lost.
Yeah.
Do you like that episode?
What last
don't
week?
Tell me.
Oh, sorry. I thought the Nikki and Paolo one went. While it was cool and neat, I thought it was a waste of time because it did not progress the basic story forward.
Oh, the final 5 minutes just made it
better. Oh, but come on! Didn't you see that coming a mile away? I saw the minute they had Arnst and the spider. The minute they had Arnst and the spider, I immediately saw everywhere that story was going. Mark Grunewald used to give assistant editor school. At Marvel, and he used to give writing classes, and he had a really great saying, which was, if the audience can see it coming, it's a crime. If they can come up with something better, it's a sin. That's a really good rule. It's weird. Like, with Avengers the Initiative, we knew the first issue had to do so many things and how it had to end. And the reaction we've been getting is really weird, where we get all these guys who are like, I didn't see that coming. Oh, that was so cool when this happened. And then we get a whole bunch of people going, I saw it coming a mile away. So it's, any other questions or stuff? Or?
Oh, yeah, actually.
Oh, sure, shoot.
We started talking about Lost after.
Yeah.
Let's say you have a script written and completed, and you really don't know if it's good or not. You think it's great. I guess a lot of people think what they do is always good, but you really don't know. Who do you go to look at it?
Your friends.
Well, your friends don't really call it a single person.
No, that's even better. Because, so, how many guys read comics, and when you're reading them, you're like, and you give them to a friend, you're like, what is this? Who is, symbiote? What the, I don't get it. You know, anyone should be able to pick up a comic and read it.
Let's say you want to professionally critique, because your friends know less than anything. They're like, oh, this looks great. Someone punching somebody. Fantastic.
And we're talking a full 22-page script?
Yeah.
Good luck. Because, no, it really comes down to the most valuable commodity that every writer has, every artist has, every editor has, is time. And it's constantly a fight against time to get that job in, to meet that deadline, to get that book to press, oh my God, that issue's coming up and we don't have an artist yet, oh my God, we got to make phone calls. They really don't have time to read a full script. I know it sucks, but they don't. You're just going to have faith in yourself. And you gotta break in. You're not gonna break in with a script. You're gonna break in with a springboard, yeah. Unless you've got like a full comic finished somewhere else. You're not gonna break in with a script. I can't think of any editor I know who reads full scripts. Yeah. It's just they don't have the time. Have you guys seen how many books Tom Brevoort edits? That's scary. And then you see how much time he spends online talking to fans. And then writing his column. Yeah, and he's got a wife and two kids and a mortgage. He has a life, and yet he finds all this time. And I'm going to give you one of his terrible secrets. Every weekend he sleeps until 3, and he honestly believes he stores it up like nuts in winter. He honestly thinks his body works that way, and he's wrong. But that's how he does it. He's psychosomatically believes that if he gives up that chunk of his life, sleeping in and hibernating till 3 o'clock on Saturdays and Sundays, he can somehow do all that crap. And he's in at the office. He's the first guy in, and he leaves like every night, like, you know, one of the last guys out. And then he goes home and he immediately, like, he eats his dinner with his family really quick, says goodnight to the kids, tucks them in bed, and goes online and deals with all the fans. It's crazy. And somehow, every now and then, like a 20-minute call for me about, hey, did you see that episode of Lost? So.
How do you go about doing springboards, though? Because, I don't know, I guess a lot of editors never come here with electronic comics, I noticed.
Well, so, there's email, and there's also good old reliable snail mail.
So, like, how much of that actually gets read in email?
Not a lot.
If you keep spamming them every week, do you think eventually they will, or is that just...
No, if you keep spamming them every week, they'll figure out who the hell you are, and then they'll avoid you like the plague. So, no, trust me, oh my God. there are guys that get that, oh, crap, it's him. It's also, that's another creepy part of the job. It's also your job to be charismatic and personable and to not be freaky. Because, oh my God, people have the freaky stories. I can tell you freaky stories. And it works both ways, too. Let me tell you some fun Marvel freaky stories. I used to give the Marvel tours at Marvel Comics, and you'd take the kids around and you show them how a comic is made, and it would usually be like a school group with some chaperones from the school, and you take them all around the office and show them all the stuff, and at one point you'd take them into an editor's office and he'd give them the spiel, and at the end of the tour you would meet Spider-Man. And I'd be like, yay! And we'd have someone on staff be Spider-Man, someone who had the right build and knew their Spidey lore and could talk to the kids, and it would sound like they knew what they were talking about. And then we'd shovel them out the door with some free comics and everyone would have fun. But something always ended up happening on the Marvel tour. So it's a good Marvel tour story. The best one, we'll just cut to the chase. I used to always take people into certain editors were great with groups, and they were very charismatic and great with kids, and that every time to a man was Fabian Nicieza and Rob Tokar were the best. And Rob edited stuff like the Transformer comics and Captain Planet and Alpha Flight, and Fabian did stuff like Wonder Man and Barbie and Ren and Stimpy and all kinds of good stuff. And one time, both Fabian and Rob were busy. I said, Dan, you can't, it's Friday, we're getting books out, you can't do the tour. And I started going down editor alley, and I started going from editor to editor, and I had my fallback guys couldn't do it. And I had guys I'd never used before, but they were funny on staff, and they couldn't do it. And I got down to the point where there's one editor left, and I was dreading it, because I knew this editor, and I'm not going to name names, but the editor was the worst human being I've ever met on the face of planet Earth. Just a horrible excuse for a human being. And he was just so freaking awful. And it wasn't just that he was insulting or mean or horrible. He was a bigot. He was a racist. He was just a horrible, horrible man. There, I've given away something. I've given away the fact that the gender. So now you know it's a male employee. But I will say nothing else. But I kind of go like, my last editorial office, nowhere else to go. And I go up, can I bring the tour in here? And he thinks about it. And he goes, sure thing, Danny. You bring the tour in here. He'll be fine. And I'm showing the kids around the office. I'm showing them how comics are made. I'm taking them through the bullpen, showing them all the neat stuff. And then I take them to the office, and I shovel them all in. And I swear to God, the group of kids I had, it was a Benetton ad. It was mix of every race, creed, color, religion. It was just all of humanity in one room, and it was from a school that was like a church school, so one of the actual chaperones was an honest-to-God collar-wearing priest. So it's a bad joke ready to happen. And the editor is sitting there, and he's never really done this before, and he's never really interacted, and he's not the most sociable person. And he's like, well, what do I got here? I got pages of this superhero. I got this. When I put my comics together, I call this guy on the phone. I say, hey, where are the pages? I do this or that. And then he starts warming up. And he starts getting good. He starts showing the kids the pages of the superhero. And look how he drew him punching that guy. And yeah, he's doing this great job. Not bad. Okay, everybody. Well, let's thank the editor for their time. Thank you very much. Okay, we're going to wrap up the tour. Everybody say goodbye. And I'm moving them all out the door. And so I go, oh, wait one second. And I'm like, all the hairs on my neck. It's just, I knew. And I turn back to me. Yeah? He's like, I want to ask you guys a question. How many of you kids read books? Not comic books. Books. I'm the one, the kids are kind of raising their hands. And the adult chaperones are looking at each other. And yes, okay, that's good. Because you kids, you got to keep reading books. You can't just read the comic books. You got to read books, too. And all the adults are like, the priest is not as good. Because if you don't, the Japs are going to take over everything. There you go. Thank you, everyone, for your time. Everyone, thank you. That's like my favorite tour story because it was like, and there's an extra beat. It's not as funny, but there's an ender, Mark McLaurin. So now you know that ender wasn't Mark McLaurin. But Marcus McLaurin was doing a book, it was either Hellraiser or Hellblazer. Which one does DC own? DC owned Hellblazer. It was Hellraiser with the pinhead guys. And it was a beautiful painted book. And he got this thing back, the blue book. And the blue book, by the time you get the blue book back, and they don't do this anymore, this is so outdated and so almost Gutenberg Bible-like, but the blue book is, it's this blue scan of the comic. By the time you're getting the blue book in your hands, you can't make changes. This is the thing that's coming out. And he got the blue book in, and he just noticed in the blue book there was a horrible error. And he can't change it. And it's a painted book. So it's this gorgeous book. It's not even like a, you know, good collot of money. And this edit, he's a large, large man, comes out with this thing crushed in his hand. And here I am with the tour, with the collar wearing crease. And he comes, then we just had this incident. He comes running down the hall screaming. He's like, fuck me, fuck me, fuck me, fuck me. And that was the extra beat at the end of that day. So the other things that would happen on the Marvel tours were this one guy that we used for Spider-Man was really good. He was really good with the kids, and he loved Spider-Man. He knew all his Spider-Man stuff. He had an athletic build, but he had that kind of wiry Spider-Man body, so he looked great in the suit. But there was one problem. His name was Ed. One problem with Ed was Ed could have been a porn star. And it was a really tight costume. And it was really distracting. And none of the kids would ever notice. But you're there with the adult chapter. So you'd have this thing where all the kids are like, hey, Spider-Man, hey, Spider-Man, what about this, what about that? All the adults would be like. Yeah, that every time. And this one time, and Ed was really quick, and whenever kids would ask him a question like, why don't you shoot your webs? Why don't you do this? Why don't you get on the wall? And he'd be like, well, I can't shoot my webs because there's valuable artwork everywhere, and if you get messed up, and why don't you get on the wall? Well, these walls, I don't think would support my weight, and blah, blah, blah. He was written, but he'd just keep going, and then he'd immediately do a bait and switch, like, did you hear about my latest adventure with Electro? You know, and he was really good with the kids. And this one time, this kid, and I was there, I was like, oh, man, I was laughing for hours. I was trying so hard for the rest of the story to keep it in. This one kid goes, Spider-Man, 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 Spider-Man. Yeah.
What's that?
This fast, Ed goes, that's where I keep my spare web shooter. There's a guy named Steve Bunch. He eventually went on to become editor at Vertigo. And when he was at Marvel, Steve Bunch was just like one of the most colorful characters there. Huge guy, huge fro. His shirts would always be ripped. He had like little porn things on his desk. But he was really funny, and he always had funny jokes to tell or something. And it was Steve's job during the tour to come bounding into the room because the kids would just be all over Spider-Man. And it was Ed's job to jump in and go, Spider-Man, Doc Ock is attacking the Chrysler Building. You gotta go. Spider-Man would be like, gotta go. And then he'd run as fast as he could till we could sneak him into a bathroom and get him away from the kids. And that was what Steve Bunch was supposed to do. But he would always come in and make up a new supervillain. And the new supervillain would always be something horrible that would go right over the kid's head and right square in the adult's face. Then it would just be like, Spider-Man, Spider-Man, Captain Smegma's attacking the Empire State Building. And you'd just be like, oh, Jesus Christ. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for being Marvel. I love doing the tours. Okay, so now I've just told you all these useless tour stories, which had nothing to do about writing our comics, but I just felt like telling them this morning because I had nothing prepared. Is there any other questions about writing for comics or embarrassing Marvel moments? Yeah.
I usually ask writers, what do you do when you have writer's block and you're on a pitch deadline?
That is a very, very good question. There's a number of things you can do. A good thing that I do is usually by the time that writer block hit, it's about 3 in the morning, and I just, whatever I'm doing, pick up and go for a walk. It's just to clear my head. The worst thing I find I can do is just keep reading the thing over and over again and try to force the idea to come. But sometimes you just don't have the time, and you have to get through that writer's block. I'm very lucky because I have friends around the world, so I call them at different hours. So I have my England friend who I can call. Like if I'm at the 5 in the morning and I got to hit that deadline by 9. Bouncing ideas off friends is great. Ty's here, and Ty Templeton's one of my best friends, and I bounce stuff off Ty all the time. And he bounces stuff off me, too. And there'll be ideas of mine I see in his Bongo comics and ideas where he helped me reach that idea, and he'll go, hey, that's my bit. I'm like, that's not your bit. You helped me find that bit. That's my bit. Very territorial about my bit. But yeah, every now and then there's a tie line in my stuff. Friends are a huge help. If you want some magic mojo, there's a thing called the Creative Whack Pack. That's the things it helps teach you are very useful. I'm never going to get the guy's name right, but it's called the Creative Whack Pack or the Creativity Whack Pack. And the basic gag is, if you don't have anyone to bounce your ideas off of, and they're not accessible to you at the time, really what you're doing when you're bouncing ideas off a friend is you're trying to find a paradigm shift. You're stuck in a box, and you're by talking to a friend and bouncing ideas off a friend, they might say something completely left field, something that is useless to you, that doesn't apply to what you're doing at all. But the shock of that knocks you out of your box and gets you to approach it from a different angle. So one of the things, the Creative Whack Pack is, it's like a friend for the friendless. It's this deck of cards, and what's on the cards is like 64 cards, and there's like 64 paradigms. So you randomly shuffle the cards, and you pull out the card, and it would say the same kind of stupid thing your friend might say that is completely off base, but it might shock you out of your box. Like, it might say, who are your favorite comedians? How would they approach this problem? How would Woody Allen approach this problem? This isn't helping me. This is Arkham Asylum. Hey, wait a minute. You know, and it gets you out of that box. Or a lot of times, like, some of the paradigms on the cards might be something that just stick in your head. So, like, I haven't used mine in years and years and years and years. But, like, I remember one card had a really useful saying on it. It was by a designer named Richard Love, and it was, only the most foolish of mice would hide in a cat's ear, but only the wisest of cats would think to look there. Which is a fancy way of saying, why not do the obvious idea? You know, why not just go straight at it? Don't be afraid of doing the obvious. The way we were talking earlier about, if the audience can see it coming, it's a crime. If they can think of something better, it's a sin. Don't feel, like a lot of times when I'm talking to Ty, when he's working on his stories and he's stuck, he tries so hard to constantly take a left turn. Didn't see that coming, huh? That a lot of times, if you just go straight ahead, it suckers people for the next left turn. You can get them two pages later. You don't have to be clever with every damn idea at every damn moment. Sometimes it's more important to hit a scene that's so, like we were saying before, endemic to your character. If you do something that's so in your face obvious, sometimes you hit on that idea that, holy crap, that's so obvious. Why hasn't anyone done that before? And sometimes those are the greatest beats of all, where someone hits that and they go, Spider-Man's been around since 1961 and no one's done that yet? Yeah, because it was so freaking obvious. It was right there. We've done stuff like that. And some of those hit you when you're doing something at the last minute, like that. Like when, did any guys read Spider-Man Human Torch? Okay. You know the issue 3 with the Spider-Mobile? He's got the Spider-Mobile and the Red Ghost and the Super Apes steal the Spider-Mobile. I'm doing this story, and I'm like, there have been a number of Spider-Mobile stories, and there's this beat that was just so obvious to me, that if you're Spider-Man, and you've got the Spider-Mobile, this vehicle that can drive up walls, there was something that he should have done with that Spider-Mobile for years, and he never did it. And then that was our last page of the issue, where he goes through this whole adventure. And during the adventure, like almost every other Spider-Man adventure, there's a scene where J. Jonah Jameson calls him like, that menace, that idiot, you know, and he's like, oh, that Jonah. And then as you're reading the story, there's a moment where he's got the Spider-Mobile, and he's going to have to give back the magic device that lets it drive up walls. And he's going to have to give it back to Reed Richards. And he says to Reed Richards, like, can I please keep it for 5 more minutes? Just let me have 5 minutes. And Reed's like, why? And Human Torch goes, oh, let him have it. He's had a hard day. Let him have the thing for 5 minutes. And you cut to like a splash page of Peter of Spider-Man in the Spider-Mobile doing donuts on the side of the Daily Bugle. And J. Jonah Jameson Lee, like, you menace! Get off my building! You know, and that's, why wouldn't you do that? You know, that's, it's so freaking obvious. And then we got so many letters and people going, that was like the best Spider-Man bit. That's not doing anything even remotely clever. I'll use the Spider-Mobile to break into his house and be on the ceiling and blah, 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 blah. No. You know, there you go. And everyone, like, people remember that beat. And I owe that to the Creative Whack Pack as just a suggestion. It doesn't hurt you to do the obvious. It's like when Grant Morrison, did anyone read Skrull Kill Crew? If you haven't, this is a really good thing to look for in the back issues. Because this is like before Grant Morrison became Grant Morrison in the U.S. And they got him to do a miniseries at Marvel. And the miniseries, in one of the first Fantastic Four appearances with the Skrulls, Reed hypnotized the Skrulls into thinking they were cows. And what you find out was that these cows kept breeding and that people slaughtered the meat and made it into hamburgers. And now all these people in the Midwest have Skrull DNA mixed in them. And it's kind of like they live. They become like sleeper agents. Now they're going to take over Earth for the Skrulls. And these kids that have the meat in them, they can see who are really the Skrulls. And they become the Skrull Kill Crew and they start killing people. And there is an issue, and it was so cool. Grant Morrison does this, where you just look at the characters fresh and you do the obvious beat. We had a scene with Captain America in a diner. And Cap's going after the Skrull Kill Crew guys, and he just takes a break in the diner. And the girl in the diner who gets to wait on Cap, it's like the greatest honor in her life. It's like, there's Captain America in my diner in the Midwest. And she brings him a thing of apple pie, because she figures that's what Captain America eats. And then she looks at the pie and looks at Cap and realizes what she's done. And she's so embarrassed. Like, oh, I just assumed you're Cap. And Cap takes, I love apple pie. Thank you. And eats it. And now she feels good. That whole scene, everyone acted so in character. You're a girl in the Midwest. Captain America, you bring him apple pie. You look at him, oh my God, you're embarrassed you brought him apple pie. And Cap's the greatest guy in the world. So he takes it with a smile and eats it. That scene writes itself. But it only takes someone who's brave enough to look at that blank page and write that obvious scene. And it really does write itself sometimes. If you just have faith in the characters. That's another thing about writing for licensed characters. If you stay true to them, if you're endemic to them, and you're true to the character, they will write themselves. These are proven characters. They've been around for 40, 60 years. And they've been around for 40 or 60 years because they work. And if you just trust them and give yourself over to the character. Oh, there's another good writing thing. If you're alone and like you have your own place and you're writing, do the voices. It always helps. I mean, every issue of the thing got better when I started doing the voices. But Alicia, honey, baby, you know. Yeah, exactly. You do the thing, and he writes himself. I don't know, Stretcho. It looks pretty complicated to me. You know, and it so helps when you do the voices. The only time it really backfired on me was I had a roommate. And when I was doing Ren and Stimpy, and he'd just be like, shut up! I have to do the voices, man, or it doesn't work! You know. Doing the voices helps. Even if it doesn't work for you, just do it out loud. It's really good. Any other questions about writing or breaking in or anything? Anything? Bueller? Bueller? Anybody?
What about writing story beats, like when you're picking up the script and you move through, you know,
exactly. Those are great. But one of the things you have to do is don't fall in love with your moments. Slay your little darlings. We had, for Initiative 1, I knew what the issue had to achieve. And the issue had to have a modicum of seriousness. It could have light moments, but there had to be an overall vein, especially with me writing it, that people are going to walk in with all these preconceptions of what a Dan Slott Initiative book is going to be like from me doing great, like Avengers and She-Hulk, and I had to tone back the comedy. And there is one scene with Hank Pym on the bus talking to all the Initiative recruits, telling them what was going to be expected of them when you get off this bus, and then blah, 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 blah. And there was a joke in there. And I get this email from Jim McCann, who's one of Marvel's promotion guys, who's been plugging this book like crazy. He read the first plot, and more than any project of Marvel, fell in love with this thing. It's on his screensaver. He's just the biggest Initiative booster, which is great. But he sends me an email because someone forwarded him the script, and this was a script in progress. we were still going to make changes, and he had just wrote on and on about how he had this favorite line, and he was telling everybody about this line, and oh, he couldn't wait to see it in print, and I had to write back saying, Jim, yeah, that was a really great line. That was the first thing I cut, because it was a funny line, and it was too good, and it became too strong a beat in the middle of a scene, and it stole from the scene. Like having, like, did anyone ever see when Giuliani gave his acceptance speech and his son kept going, that's what that beat was in my story. It was a great beat and it was funny, but it was stealing from the scene where Yellow Jacket comes onto the bus and everyone's like, Founding Avenger on the deck. And everyone's like, on the bus, the original shot of everyone on the bus being all in awe. They weren't in awe because in the final script, they're in awe and shock because Hank Pym's kind of telling him, you know, all the horrible things that are going to happen to them at the initiative and everything that's expected upon them and the weight of the world on their shoulders and you're stepping on hallowed ground and but the original line was just Cloud Nine, the shy girl, going, oh my God, that's Yellow Jacket. Like, there's a celebrity on the bus. And then Slapstick, the comic character, goes, hey, we're in the military. That's full Yellow Jacket. And then someone did a joke off that. And you go, oh, I love Full Yellow Jacket. Full Yellow Jacket. That's all right. Like, that line is so gone. So, yeah, you have to, as yes, there's your beats and your beats and your story beats, and it builds up to something, and it builds up to that climactic splash page or that really cool story moment. But you have to know what is it you're trying to do in your story. When you're writing your story, don't worry about that at all. Be true to your characters and tell the story and let them say what they're going to say. But then you have to take a step back and you have to be at a level of craft. You have to look at, what am I trying to do with this story? Where is it going? And you have to be true with that and maybe take another pass or another pass. We do that all the time in She-Hulk. I can't even tell you how many scenes in She-Hulk in the plot have ended up on the floor, how many lines have ended up on the floor. It's scary. Other times, there are times we just have to get the book out. And that book gets out no matter what. And then I go back and read a joke and go, oh my God, that was such a 3 a.m. joke. Why is that in the book? But there's no fixing it. It's in the book. But you guys read She-Hulk? There is a scene, it was a great scene in issue 12 of our first run. And if we could have made it a double-sized, I would have said keep it. One of the things that we kept cutting in She-Hulk a lot was her relationship with John Jameson. That she'd always get these scenes where we'd have these lovey-dovey scenes with her and John Jameson or a romantic moment. And it was great subplot. It was great soap opera. But it didn't move whatever the story of the month was. And we had this great beat where he was on an aircraft carrier when Titania was attacking the city. And all these superheroes and everyone's going to help. She's just getting killed by Titania because Titania's got the gem of power from the Infinity Gauntlet on her head. And she's stronger than she's ever been. And she's just wailing on She-Hulk. She's going to kill She-Hulk. And oh my God, She-Hulk's even reverted into Jen Walters. So now she's at her weakest. And Titania's at her strongest. And oh my God, what's going to happen? And that's when all the heroes are coming into the rescue. And She-Hulk's just going to be beating the crap out. Well, Titania is going to beat the crap out of them. While She-Hulk, as Jen Walters, is going to come up with a clever solution to save the day. Because Jen has way more inner beauty and inner strength and inner resolve than She-Hulk does outer. Because she's our main hero and we love her. But I was going to have a scene where, in the middle of all this fight, John Jameson hears that his girl's in trouble. So he knocks out a guy and he steals a plane from the deck and he flies into Manhattan. He's going through the buildings in his F-14 and he sees Titania and he's shooting. And she's, all the shells are blasting off and it's having no effect. And she throws something and he hits the ejector and he ejects out of the F-14 in time and it comes wafting down to Earth. And there's Pug. And Pug's just been a complete schlub in this whole story, and there's nothing that he's done that's been any help. And here he deeply loves She-Hulk, but She-Hulk loves John Jameson. And when John Jameson lands, he's decked out in sci-fi weapons. And all these guys are running up to him, and Doc Samson comes up, because all the heroes were helping out in the fight. And Doc Samson's like, Colonel Jameson, it's a good thing you're here. Hey, I haven't seen you since you were running security at Ravencroft Prison. Captain America comes over. It's my old partner, John Jameson. He used to be my pilot. You were like a partner and buddy to me, as much as the Falconer Nomad. You know, everyone was like, John Jameson, you're the greatest thing in the world. You're a golden god. And he's like, I thought I could help. I brought these weapons from when I used to be a monster hunter in Amazing Spider-Man. Like, he's like the richest, most history of the Marvel Universe. And he turns to Pug, like, oh, hey, Puck. Pug. He's like, maybe you could help out. I brought some spare guns here. And Pug takes the gun and immediately shoots himself in the foot. So it was going to be this really great scene about it. Here's John and here's Pug. And that, if you can picture that in your head, that's got to take at least 6 pages, that whole sequence. And where's She-Hulk? What's going on? And whose book is this? That all went right on the floor. And the minute that went on the floor, Pug's redeeming moment was when Awesome Andy's hurt. And Pug was going to do the bit where he's going to use his lawyer skills to save Pug by saying to Mr. Fantastic, you know, use the Good Samaritan clause. If you go by and leave Awesome Andy dying, you helped make him, you know, I'll sue you. I'll sue you for everything you've got, Mr. Fantastic. You helped my friend. And that was going to be a redeeming moment for Pug. But with all that John Jameson stuff taken out of the book, we didn't need a redeeming moment for Pug. And since we were coming to a nice wrap-up, and I knew I was going to have the ending with She-Hulk and Holden Holloway, her kind of fake father figure in the book, at the end, I thought, no, that's a Holloway scene now. I'll give that scene with Holloway. And Pug can just go off to the hospital with Mallory, and I won't have to deal with him. So sometimes the story writes itself, and sometimes the beats, you have to stay true to what your story is. This is so weird. I'm saying everything to you that Tom Brevoort says to me, because he's always telling me what stuff I have to kill or what's the important stuff of the story. And yeah, so trust me, you'll do much better when you have an editor. They're great. Any other questions about writing comics or breaking in or yeah?
I'm far ahead of the way of comics. Okay. The story is going like 6 months.
Yeah. Well, it's my goal. It's my dream to do these kind of epic things like Walt Simonson did, where you'd read the Soda Saga, and holy crap, that built up for like 2 years, and it kept building and building and building. It was so awesome, and so many of us, we'd love to do that. So I've got stuff that we've set the seeds for in She-Hulk with the Reckoning War, if you read issue 100, that we're going to get to that, and little seeds have been planted, and then there's something I've been seeding in every single thing I've been writing for Marvel for the past 4 years, with the exception of the Blackjack stories and Amazing Fantasy and the Two-Gun Kid one-shot. With the exception of those, every project I've worked on had a little seed building into something. And people are beginning to see the bigger picture now. Like, hey, Southpaw has the left gauntlet, and Gauntlet has the right gauntlet, and hey, wait a minute, what about that, and what about... And eventually it'll all come together and form a puzzle. So there's planning like that, where you can plan months and months and months in ahead. But that can also bite you in the ass. Because for the thing, I had a plan, and that plan led me to issue 25. And we got canceled at 8. So it is like this horrible gnawing pain in my, you know, my chest. It just kills me when I think we'll never get to thing 25. Because we had in issues 1 through... Well, 7 and 8's really a capper, because we didn't want you to leave you with characters like Arlo hanging around. It was going to be... the Thing has a very vapid and shallow life because he suddenly has all this money, and he's going for glitz and glamour as opposed to substance. And meanwhile, while he's been leading this shallow life and dating blonde bimbos and starlets, Alicia's dating someone of true substance, who's an artist and a poet, and he feels everything so deeply, and he's so good to her. God, you just want to punch him. And so and that's someone that's not like, he's not like a handsome Hollywood type, and he's not someone that Thing could just punch. You know, it's the worst rival in the world for him to have is the person who's great for Alicia, because he wants to be the guy who's good for Alicia. And what was going to happen is, he was, by the end of that arc, he was going to realize there's more important things than money, which is obvious, I know. And then he was going to go on a quest to kind of find his poet, and his, what inside him is worthwhile. It was going to kind of be like the second act of Groundhog Day, when Bill Murray suddenly goes, I'm going to learn to be an ice sculptor. I'm going to... Yeah, so he was going to kind of enrich himself. And then you were going to reach this point where by issue 25... he was going to propose to Alicia. Arlo was going to be out of the picture. The thing was going to make, and one of the things he was doing was he was learning to dance. He was learning to sing. He was learning to write poetry and this and that. And I had most of the thing 25 in my head was a double size issue. And I had three stories. And one story was just going to be this big Indiana Jones adventure with Thing, like someone like Black Panther or one of his friends in a weird society or in humans would give him this treasure map. It'd almost be a silent story. As he'd go through all these travails and he'd get to this treasure, and it would be this gemstone. It would be something magic, like you touch it and it lets out a magic, like whoever's holding it. And you're like, he went through all this for this, and he gets it made into an engagement ring. Because it's going to be this magical thing that makes a beautiful sound or music for Alicia. And then the middle story, you're going to start where you're going to see the Thing's hands, and it's going to be like near a sidewalk, but where you have one of those openings where you have a tree, you know, in the street, and he's looking around for rocks or pebbles, and he can't find any, so he just starts mashing his own hands till some of his orange rocky skin comes off. Then he takes some of these pebbles, and you pull back and you see your Alicia's in Soho, and he's tossing pebbles at her window. And she opens up, she stands on the balcony, she's like, who is it? Down here, baby! And then you pull back to a splash, and it's Ben Grimm in a tuxedo. And you're Ben? And you pull back to a double page splash, and all of Alicia's streets have been decked out in twinkle lights, and all of their friends are there, all dressed and elegant. And all of Ben's best friends, Gorgon, and he's got like a tuba, and Johnny's on keyboards, and so on. And they're all playing this song. And I wanted to do something that we put on an MP3 on the Marvel site, and then you could download it and read it with your comic. And Ben's written this whole song for Alicia. And he's just, and it's a really kind of Ben Grimm song, so it's like kind of tuba, kind of boom, 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 boom. And he's like, let me tell you about this girl I know, beautiful from head to toe, with a button nose on her face and a smile I have seen from space. You know, she's Alicia, my Alicia, she's the only gal for me. You know, and it was just, and she's like, Ben? And you just see this whole, and he's doing this whole, like, song and dance routine under her window, and, like, her love has changed me in more ways than being struck by cosmic rays. It makes me weak, it makes me strong. I guess I know that all along, that Alicia, my Alicia, she's the only gal for me. And it's just this really sweet little song. And by the end, it gets really tear jerky and gets you in the Gesinkte song. And Sue's there, and she makes an invisible force field to rise Ben up off the ground, so he's on one knee holding out the ring. And the last lyrics end with, like, will you marry me? And of course she says yes. And then the third story is the most tear-jerking story of all. And it's not the marriage. We keep them engaged for a while. But and so you build up all this stuff. Now it's going to be issue 25. Dead! So there you go. So you don't get to it, always. So, I don't know. As far as how you do the comics, you should be 3 months ahead, as a rule. But who here is still waiting for Ultimates 13? Huh? Yeah? Doesn't always happen that way. She-Hulk's been a grind for me. I think I care a little too much about the book, and I sweat too many of the pages, too many of the plots. And because of that, every now and then it misses shipping like by a week. Like, I'll screw up. Or in the case of this latest issue, 2 weeks. And it's really screwed up. Because now She-Hulk 18, when She-Hulk 18's over, Hulk 106 begins. Like almost instantaneously, and I've seen Hulk 106, and it gives away the ending of She-Hulk 18, and that's going to ship first because we screwed up. Let me phrase that, because I screwed up. So she should be 3 weeks ahead. With Initiative, we're on schedule, and with the big secret super project, I've got like two or three issues in the drawer. So there's no way that's missing shipping, because it's the big super secret project. If that missed shipping, someone puts a bullet in my head.
Pardon me if this is
that is totally cool.
But breaking into the industry, with regards to experience in any lines, what do you need to impress?
You need a good idea for a writer, and you need to be able to boil it down to one page. Mm-hmm. Do not put a staple in it. Do not have like another page. All your contact information should be on it. You stand a lot better chance if you've done something first for another company, like an indie book that you've published, and that you can include that with your one-page idea. For a lot of the do's and don'ts, like the dear God, don't do this, it's a lot easier to tell you what not to do than what to do. For a lot of the don'ts, Bendis has a site called Jinx World, and he has a creators board, and I have a board on the creators board. It's on a sticky, so it's always on the top, or near the top. There's a section called Easter Eggs. Go to the Easter Egg section. Every now and then I just go in and I pontificate or do something fun. Like in the Easter Egg section, I've included sample springboards that I've done in the past that have been bought or killed. Plots, like what my plots look like, what my scripts look like, and a big list of don'ts for, you know, and frequently asked questions. So you can find some cool stuff in the Easter Egg section that might help you out. JinxWorld.com, and then I'll go over to the creator boards and go to my board and look up Easter eggs.
What's the best way to find a good independent company that's a good starting point? Do you recommend any by name or anything? Or?
No. Because there's so many, and they come and they go, and they fold, and they...
They distribute them, right? That's the point, right? They were distributed.
Yes. But let me tell you, if you really have the chutzpah, if you really got that inner drive and desire... You could go the risky, financially foolish way of self-publishing. And it shows a lot of commitment. What you lose in that is that you don't really have an editor. You have your own faith in yourself. And if you're not good, then you're not doing yourself any favors. And you've just blown a lot of money. But if you are good, and you have faith in yourself and your abilities, and the team you put together, then that is a lot better than turning in... Because you should never, ever, ever turn in, here's that Xerox of this thing we did. No, but if you can turn in that comic that you self-published along with that one sheet, that's great.
And that, as an addition to it, but bring them an actual finished comic.
Yeah. Finished comic is only going to help you, unless that finished comic is the worst finished comic ever made. But it's really going
to
help you.
You're not talking about self-distribution. It's just talking about that's what you said to get hired.
Don't, if you're making a comic just for them... To make it like I made an imaginary comic that we never distributed.
No, you say you actually made a comic, you know, nice shiny cover, but you wanted to think you created your own comic. Mm-hmm. You're saying you wouldn't suggest trying to distribute yourself. You're saying send that comic to.
No, but that's a comic that got published, right?
You're saying self-published.
Yeah, but no, self-published doesn't mean that you just make it. You got to distribute it. You got to. Yeah, you got to get it out there and do something. It's hard. I've worked for companies that have a lot of financial backing that. Get a comic that doesn't sell well enough and it just languishes. Conversely, one of my friends, Mike Gazzala, who's been doing this for like 30 years, he self-publishes his stuff. And what it means is he distributes it and it gets out. You can buy it in popular retail outlets, but it means he's got in his garage like boxes of Captain Jack comics that have never been sold. And maybe some year he'll use them to make an igloo and keep himself warm.
Does he just call store by store and mail them boxes? Is that how he does it? Call stores, comic stores around America? And
I have no idea. I've never self-published. I've never had the cojones to do that. The closest I've come is I had a comic that I did for another company that they never promoted. And they just put out a little blurb in the solicit, and they were a small press. And then, gee whiz, no one ordered it. They never showed any art from it. They just put out this blurb. And everyone in the office was really happy with it. And they apologized. They said, we're sorry, but you know, we'll let a year go by and then we'll try to do it again right. And that company was claimed. And in that time, they went belly up. So I have the files for a comic I did with a character I came up with that I was really pleased with. I was really proud of. And nothing ever happened. And when I finally started doing work for Marvel, and I was getting a bit of a profile, Ty Templeton, who was working with a Canadian company here, Mr. Comics, said, hey, do you still have the files for that? I'm like, yeah. He said, you want to do it? I'm like, yeah. So it came out last year called Big Max. We just did the one. We have more Big Max stories we'd love to do. But I can't. I'm under exclusive for Marvel, and I'm not allowed. But and there's one or two stories in a drawer that there's a screaming demand for Big Max comics. we could have someone draw two existing stories. But I was really pleased, and that was kind of self-publishing in a way, in that Mr. Comics, I think there's maybe 1,600 of this or 1,800 of this out there. That's not a lot. But conversely, Big Max might be option for a movie. And now that I can show people this physical comic, and right now, this exact week, a board for the People's Republic of China, the Communist board, is reviewing Big Max because they might want to make Big Max cartoons for a Chinese cell phone company. I have a great agent. So it's funny, I get to call him James Fry and go, dude, Communist China, Big Max. Awesome. You know, I can make that joke because the same agent just sold me a TV show. So, pretty cool. So, yeah, look for it in 2008. Not the Big Max thing, my new TV show. There's a network, it's called Illusion. They're starting up in a few days. And what it is, I don't know if you get it in Canada, but if you have the Dish Network, it's on demand, and they don't broadcast. They just every week put up their new shows, and then you can select it throughout the month. You go, I want to watch that, and it's free on demand. And what it's going to be is 12 episodes of me ripping off the Twilight Zone. So there you go. But no, it's a live action, and it's just the same, like, yay! So, just, you know, twist-ending stories with time travel and werewolves and zombies. It'd be fun. Hey.
What do you think your
influence on writing that? Where do I get my influence? I just do it. But you, well, in the case of any kind of licensed property, you read up. You know when Spider-Man doesn't sound like Spider-Man. You know when the thing doesn't sound like the thing. So it's kind of your job to find that voice, but to make it have all new dialogue and all new stuff. But no, it's like I was doing an issue of Ren and Stimpy, and when I was writing it, it was just so flowing out of my fingers and onto the keyboard. Then I'm like, oh, please tell me this is all me. Please tell me there isn't some obscure Britcom that I'm pulling this out of the back of my head. This is all coming way too easily, and it's funny, and it's cracking me up. And I kept calling everybody I knew. I go, does this sound familiar? Is this all me? Because it was too good. I'm usually very critical of all my stuff, and it was cracking me up. And the scene was writing itself. Where I had Ren and Stimpy, and we don't know how they got there. Maybe they were in a ship. Maybe it went down. But they're in the middle of the Atlantic or the Pacific, the middle, water everywhere, and all that's left is Stimpy's litter box, and they're floating in it. And they're just floating, and they're out to sea. And you can just tell they've been there forever because of all like the five-day stubble and the... And Stimpy's just still happy, you know, because he's Stimpy. And he's doing this. He's like, Ren, I spy with my little eye something beginning with O. Ocean. Yeah. I spy with my little eye something beginning with S. C. I spy with my little eye something beginning with W. Water. No. Waves. Yeah. I spy with my little eye something beginning with L. What? What is it? What? Large body of water? He's just doing all these L's. He's freaking liquid. Ah! He's like land. Land, oh my God! You know, it's like, and that was too easy. That all came out in like, you know, 5 seconds. It was like as soon as I left my fingers, it bugged me for weeks. I think there was like there's one where he paused. He goes, H2O, and that's when he starts beating the crap out of Stimpy, and that's when he does the L. But it was just—it all came out so fast. Sometimes you're in the zone, and the flow hits you, and it all just starts coming out, and it's all beautiful. And then there's other times where you have to fight the white. You have to fight that blank screen, that blank page. Yeah, and to me, the times where it flows is far more scary because I'm worried about that. I'm like, this is too good, too quick, too fast. I don't like this. Any other questions? Anything? Hi.
I've been starting to write a book, a novel, and I'm getting to a point where, you know, everything just flows my sit down. It's really flows quick.
I envy you.
But now I'm starting to think, okay, so I've been thinking about publishing. So then I started reading up about publishing. And
Are you done with your novel?
Oh, no. But that's what I'm thinking. I was like, should I just finish this thing and then worry about it?
If you have a flow, it's kind of like, it's kind of like a pitcher on a good run. Don't mess with the flow. What are you doing?
Yeah, as soon as I started thinking about publishing and reading about publishing, I kind of
screw that. Stuff right, you're not. If you've got a flow, go with the flow, because you're going to hit a week where, like he was saying, you're just going to be staring at a blank page. Go with the goddamn flow.
Right.
Worry about publishing later. That when you're stuck, that's when you pull out all those little guys and try to find a publisher. And you know what? They're only probably going to want to look at like the first galleys or the first, you know, whatever, the first. But if you've got a flow, you know, the muse is kissing you. Go with it.
Okay. And second, when that time comes, do you have to write it as a scene, dialogue, scene, like a play type thing? Or do you just...
But you're writing a novel.
Yeah, it's a comic book novel.
Oh, you're writing a graphic novel.
Yeah.
Oh. Where are you going to publish this?
I don't know. This is what I mean. You know, came up with a story, invented new characters.
Oh, you're screwed. No one does graphic novels anymore. Well, actually, here Fox is starting doing that again. I was talking to Heidi McDonald over sushi because we're in New York and we're trendy. And she was saying, like, "What's your Marvel contract up?" I'm like, "Hopefully never." So I love it. But she was telling me they're going to start doing graphic novels at Fox. So there's a.
It's either that or split this up into.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's the more affordable way to do it. Yeah.
Well, I thought graphic novels have access to like respectable bookstores or considered books, and they sell better.
Yeah, but it all comes down to money, and who's going to invest the money to produce your graphic novel? You know, who's going to have faith in you?
I thought you meant like graphic novel itself. Forget it.
Oh no! They're, you know, but I think most of you know, especially with Marvel and DC doing this whole making stories as 6-issue installments so you can collect them and then stick them in a store, that, you know, that with that, they can mass produce graphic novels every 6 months or every 6 issues. So you really don't see, like, original graphic novels anymore. You got to go to other countries. Hey, we're another country. This is awesome. One thing I noticed, all you guys drive such small cars. Weird. No, it's weird. I came here. It's like matchbox cars all over the street. Where are these big honking gas guzzlers? Even your buses and trams, they're like skinny. It's all skinny and cute. You just want to pinch their little cheeks. Such cute little cars.
Concerning comic writers, how do you guys get paid?
By page? By page. And like we were saying before, you get royalties. If the book does phenomenally well, and you get reprint fees when it goes to other countries, and when it gets put into a graphic novel and reprinted,
how much is the jump from journalism to I'm a reporter? So.
Do you report on comic books?
Trade newspaper.
Okay.
I don't know.
I have no idea. I have no idea. Most people that I know that come into the industry, except for like a new crop of guys who came in via back doors, is I am a screenwriter, I am a TV person. There's a lot of that now at Marvel and DC. And look how well that worked for Wonder Woman. Have you seen this? This is crazy. Because you had Alan Heinberg from OC and Lost. He does, like, what, the first 5, which is going to be 6 issues, and they come out bi-monthly, and then he never does the 6th. And he's just kind of floating and floating and floating as one of their flagship characters, and nothing's going on. So they bring on, like, this top female writer who's going to do this great... She does 2 issues, and then she flies the coop. Then now they got, like, Jay Torres coming in, and he's going to do 2 issues. And everyone's like, what are you doing? What are you doing? And then when all that news hit, then DC out of nowhere goes, we got Gail Simone! Don't go! We have Gail! Gail will write it. But yeah, that's what happens when you get people, because, like, a lot of these guys that are, like, TV guys and movie guys... For them, comic books is like a hobby. This will be fun. I will lower myself from the heavens. I will dig down deep, and I will write myself a funny book. Then I'll go back up to TV and film. It's kind of cool. But usually, you know, but there are people that, like, I know people who worked in like comic book journalism that have like gotten their way onto staff at Marvel, like some guys who worked for CBR, some guys who worked for Wizard, some guys from Newsarama, and then they cross over. So it can happen. I'm not going to crush your dream. Anything else? Are we all good? You all good? Is that fun? Is that entertaining? Cool. Thank you very much. I'm so glad more than four people showed. I'm so glad I was able to vamp.
You know, talk about writing for comic books.